Hey, listeners. Here are a few things that I could use some help with. I'm really enjoying telling these microscopic 60 seconds or less sound stories over on Instagram and TikTok, but I need writing help. If you're a 20,000 Hertz mega fan, a general sound factoid nerd, and a good writer, reach out. I'd love to consider hiring you on a freelance basis to help me curate and write those stories. Outside of that, I love featuring other podcasts that have told incredible sound-related stories. So if you hear anything that sounds like a 20,000 Hertz story on another podcast, please send it to us. Finally, I also absolutely love hearing other people's voices on my podcast. So if you'd like to report a story on 20,000 Hertz, we're always accepting pitches. Alternatively, if you have a super compelling sound story in you that you want to get out as a guest, send us a pitch. Just write us at hi@20k.org. You're listening to 20,000 Hertz. I'm Dallas Taylor. I love traveling. When I'm in a new place, outside my comfort zone, I can feel my brain working in a new way. One of my favorite parts of traveling is hearing sounds that are different than what I'm used to. When I stayed in Italy, I was struck by how it wasn't just the language that sounded different. It was the cars, the mopeds, the birds, the footsteps on cobblestone. It was a vibrant burst of sonic information. If you intentionally become conscious about what you're hearing, you can experience this anywhere. And in some places, you can find sounds that you can't hear anywhere else in the world. Even here in the US, there are some truly unique sounds that you need to know about. This episode features two stories from one of my favorite podcasts, Atlas Obscura. There have actually been a handful of 20,000 Hertz episodes that were directly inspired by the posts I found on the Atlas Obscura website, so I'm really excited to play you some of their show. I'll let producer Johanna Mayer take it from here.
Times Square is not my favorite part of New York City. But today, that's where I'm headed.
Okay, where is this thing supposed to be? Don't actually know where I'm supposed to be going. Ooh. All right, so it's on Broadway between 45th and 46th. Okay, this way.
It's a perfect early fall day in Manhattan.
Oh, there's Elmo. Oh, this is where, like, all the characters are. There's Spider-Man, there's Mickey, there's Minnie, there's the Hulk.
I am not here to take in the usual sights of the area. The hustle and bustle, a Broadway show, the M&M store. I'm here because I'm looking for a great and a sound. Obviously, there are a lot of greats and sounds in Times Square, but I'm looking for one in particular.
Oh, maybe I haven't gone quite far enough yet. Oh, wait, here's a big great. If there's a hum down here, I'm not really hearing it. Maybe I do hear it. Oh, yeah, this is it, for sure. Really listen for that. I would have walked over that. I probably have walked over this.
It takes me a second to find the hum I'm looking for. But once I do, I cannot unhear it. There's nothing to draw your attention to the sound. No plaque, no signage. But the hum is actually a piece of art. It's a decades-old sound installation by an experimental composer named Max Neuhaus. He was the pioneer in the world of sound art, and he wanted to make work that, quote, didn't require indoctrination. In other words, art that didn't require learning about it in a textbook or visiting some tucked-away gallery. The piece is officially called Times Square, but it's often just referred to as the hum. The sound rises up out of a grate on a pedestrian triangle on one of the busiest sections of one of the busiest streets in the entire world. It's right in the thick of the bright lights and ads where the ball drops on New Year's Eve. It occurs to me that the Hum might be the most visited piece of art in the world. About 30,000 people visit the Mona Lisa every day, and about 300,000 people pass through Times Square daily. The difference, of course, is that very few people realize that they're visiting a piece of experimental art when they're here. I stand there for a while, watching people pose for pictures right on top of the grate. I have a question for you. Can you hear this, like, hum underneath us that we're standing on? Do you hear sort of, like, almost like bells or, like, a little hum?
No.
No?
No.
Not at all? Do you think you ever would have noticed this?
No, I would not have.
It's like a sound art. I'm trying to see if people noticed it. You didn't notice it at all?
I didn't notice it. When you tell me, we just noticed.
I feel like I look a little crazy. I'm like asking people if they notice. Totally silent noise. Eventually, I catch the eye of someone else who's clearly not a tourist. Someone who, just like me, is out here working in Times Square on a Saturday afternoon. You're the Naked Cowboy, right?
I'm the Naked Cowboy, and I'm keeping the rear for you. Hold on.
If you don't know the Naked Cowboy, it's pretty much exactly what he sounds like. A dude wearing nothing but cowboy boots, a cowboy hat, and tidy whiteys. He's kind of a fixture in Times Square.
Well, I have a question. So did you know that this is like an outdoor and art installation?
Yeah. They got some stupid freaking thing here. It makes a noise.
So how did you find out about it?
Well, I've been here for 25 years every day.
Do you stand over this thing often?
Well, I mean, in the winter, it's generates a little heat, but not much. Let's sing a song for you. Blue eyes crying in the rain. Don't you dare cry in this rain.
So cute.
Look, I gotta let you go.
I'm taking a picture. Yeah, go for it.
What's the value in adding one more sound to one of the noisiest streets in America? Max Neuhaus called this hum part installation, part social experiment. And that was kind of his thing. Neuhaus was born in 1939 in Texas, and he started his artistic life as a composer. He began to make a name for himself in classical music circles, and he got really into experimental contemporary and percussive music in the 60s. In the late 60s, Neuhaus began making what he called sound installations. He installed speakers in an arboretum and piped in electronic sounds to make it feel like some sort of oral plant food. Another time, he linked a radio station with a phone network and asked people to call in, and then mixed up the sounds live on air. In 1977, Neuhaus built the Hum. He climbed into a vent shaft underneath a grate and installed a speaker and homemade electronic sound generators that he somehow connected to a nearby street lamp for power supply. It hummed away until 1992, then it was disconnected. But as the years went by and Neuhaus got more famous, a gallerist worked to get the Hum reconnected. It started up again in 2002. And it's been down there ever since. Even during a period of construction in 2015, when scaffolding covered up the grate and people couldn't lean in close, it was never turned off. It just kept humming into the ether. After a lot of lurking around and awkwardly sticking my recorder at what looks like a regular old subway grate, I see a couple of youngish guys crouching down over the grate. They're side by side, but not talking, heads bent down. Could these be my people?
Excuse me. Sorry to interrupt. Can I ask you guys a couple questions?
Yeah.
I'm a podcast reporter. Are you listening for the sound design on it? So you guys actually know about it?
Yeah.
Oh, that's so exciting. You're the first people I've talked to all day who can actually hear it.
Yeah.
You really gotta focus and like zone in a little bit. Oh, my name is Rishabh.
I'm his brother. I'm Rahul.
What brought you guys here?
I actually knew about this. I was writing a screenplay for a film. I'm a film major. And I kind of wrote the sound installation into my film. I was looking for things that was not, like, was something somewhat hidden in New York and not, like, not something very common that people would expect. So, this felt like something that was very spiritual, you know, in the middle of something that's very crowded.
So chaotic. Yeah.
What does it sound like to you?
They're like these Buddhist bowls, you know? It's kind of like this oscillating, reverberating sound that's calming and droning, almost like something's being birthed or created out of thin air.
Like the Tibetan singing bowls.
Yeah.
How would you describe it?
I hear also Om, which is the sound of creation in India. So I just hear like a group of people saying Om.
What do you think is the point of having a piece like this that there's no explanation, many people will just be walking across it and never realize it? What value do you think it brings, or what makes it worthwhile?
It's not just the sound itself, it's everything around you as well. So it's like the horns, the people walking, people talking, the cyclists riding. And then when you just focus in on sound and you're not thinking about visuals, that resonation gets louder and louder, and it permeates through everything else. So, I mean, in a way, it's almost like it's New York talking to you, you know?
If you want to experience the Times Square hum, walk along Broadway till you get to a pedestrian island between 45th and 46th Streets. Look for a large triangular grate. It's maybe 20 feet long. The hum is loudest at the north end of it. And then just listen. You might hear New York talking to you.
After the break, we'll leave the city behind and explore a deep cave in Virginia to hear the largest instrument in the world. Why should you learn another language with Babbel? Well, there are a ton of reasons, but let's see how many I can fit into 60 seconds. First, Babbel works fast. You can start having conversations in another language in as little as 3 weeks. Next, it makes overseas vacations more fun and less stressful. I used it all the time on my last trip to Italy. If you work with foreign collaborators, Babbel can help you deepen those relationships. It's a fun thing to do when you need a break, and it's way better than doom scrolling. Babbel teaches you about other cultures. Speaking for myself, learning something new just makes me feel good. It's very affordable. And finally, signing up for Babbel helps support 20,000 Hertz. Okay, make that 8 reasons, or 8 ragioni, as they'd say in Italian. To get started on a new language today, here's a special limited-time deal for 20,000 Hertz listeners. Get 55% off your Babbel subscription right now at babbel.com/20k. This offer is only available for our listeners. That's babbel.com/20k for 55% off. babbel.com/20k. Rules and restrictions may apply. Congratulations to Kaz Mori for getting last episode's mystery sound right. That's the chime that plays when you walk through the doors of a Family Mart, which is a popular chain of convenience stores in Japan. This chime was composed in 1978 by Yasushi Inada. Here he is in 2015 playing the melody on piano. And here's this episode's mystery sound. If you know that sound, submit your guess at the web address mystery.20k.org. Anyone who guesses it right will be entered to win one of our, say it with me now, super soft 20,000 Hertz t-shirts. Thanks to Shopify for sponsoring 20,000 Hertz. But that's not the only thing I have to thank them for, because I built the first ever web store for 20,000 Hertz using Shopify. Without Shopify, I probably would have never gotten those legendary super soft t-shirts into production. And the whole process was super easy. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. Whether you're selling handmade dog costumes, customized wedding supplies, or super soft t-shirts from a brand new podcast, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. When we started out, our Shopify-powered store was one of the reasons I could afford to keep going. And according to their data, Shopify-powered websites have an almost 40% higher conversion rate compared to other platforms. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/20k, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/20k to start growing your business, no matter what business you're in. Shopify.com/20k. For me, the hardest part of hiring is narrowing down the search, and that's where Indeed can help. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million visitors every month. That makes it the world's largest platform for finding skilled staff. In fact, during the time it'll take me to read this ad, 23 people will have been hired on Indeed. Whenever we list a job, we get a lot of applications. So many of them are from brilliant and talented people. But it can be really hard to have those applications rise to the top. With Indeed's smart matching engine, that process becomes a lot easier. And over time, the matching engine learns your preferences. The more you use it, the more efficient it becomes. According to a recent Indeed survey, 93% of employers said that Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites. Right now, our listeners can get a $75 sponsored job credit at Indeed.com/Hertz. That's Indeed.com/HERTZ. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
In the Shenandoah Valley of Virginia, in the Blue Ridge Mountains, there's a network of dark, cold caves called Luray Caverns.
That's Dylan Thuris, the host of Atlas Obscura.
A path leads down into the cave, and it takes you past Dream Lake, a big pool with this calm, reflective surface. And all around it, there are a ton of stalactites hanging down from the ceiling and stalagmites reaching up from the ground. It's this jaw-droppingly beautiful space. But wander a little further into the cave, and your jaw might drop a little more. Because there, in the middle of the cave, is an enormous organ. And this isn't your average church organ, because instead of pipes, every key of this organ is connected to a tiny mallet that hits a different stalactite.
So my parents came to me and said, well, for your birthday, you get your choice. We can have a birthday party, or we can take a trip to a cave. And I said, the cave.
That's Robert Sprinkle. He's about 70 now, but this is a story that takes place when he was just a little boy.
In 1954, when we went to the cave, I was 5 years old. And that's where the magic happened.
That cave they visited was Luray Caverns in Virginia, part of the Shenandoah National Parks. But long before it became a national park, millions of years ago, the Luray Caverns were underwater, part of an ancient sea. And slowly, over the years, the water drained, leaving these large, dark caverns behind. As water slowly dripped down from the cave ceilings, minerals would accumulate, bit by bit, forming these gigantic stalactites. They hang from above like these gigantic stone icicles, up to 500 feet long. And for little Robert Sprinkle, it was an absolutely magical place.
I declared to my mother, I was only five and I had a little bit of trouble enunciating at that point. This is the best boot day anybody's ever had. Toward the end of the tour, we got to a place where a very large piece of what used to be the ceiling had broken off, and it had a row of fairly small stalactites. The guide we had took this little rubber rod and struck several stalactites and played Mary Had a Little Lamb. In that instant, my father imagined the entire project that would occupy him until his death in 1990. He thought of the whole thing. He thought of what it would need. He knew he could do all parts of it.
Robert Sprinkle's father was Leland Sprinkle. And Leland Sprinkle's idea was this: to build a giant organ right there in the Luray Caverns. And to do this using ancient stalactites in the place of the pipes. At the end of the tour, Mr. Sprinkle rushed to the visitor center and asked to speak with the owner. The person selling souvenirs pointed to Mr. Gray's office, and Leland Sprinkle marched in, stoic and determined. Here's his son, Robert.
He said, "Look, this is who I am, an electronics engineer at the Pentagon. I work on the UNIVAC computer, and I could turn your cave into a musical instrument."
The UNIVAC computer was the first general-purpose computer, and the Pentagon was the very first place to have one installed. These machines were very large and very rare. So, in other words, this guy, Leland Sprinkle, was next-level smart.
And the owner, strangely, said, "Okay, see what you can do." And they shook hands, and there you go. I mean, looking back on it, it was really kind of nuts.
This kind of agreement could, literally never happen now. It's pretty hard to imagine the National Park System letting someone come in and just chisel at the ancient stones.
In that period, that never came up, you know, defacing rocks or something. It might have been the last era in which that could have been done.
In the two-hour drive home, Robert's father was quiet. Whatever excitement his father had for this project, he didn't show it, at least not outwardly. Here's Robert.
"No, not giddy. My dad wasn't a giddy kind of guy, rather taciturn. He was lost in thought, as far as I could tell. Purposeful and optimistic, I think, would be fairer."
By the time they arrived home, Leland had composed in his head a list of all the materials that he would need. And he got straight to work.
So he started constructing the electronics upstairs on a table that my son now uses for his computer. Cherry table, actually. It's a very nice table. He often was bent over soldering things, you know, and I soldered some things too. So I helped now and then to the extent I could.
There was no textbook for building a giant organ in a cave, a giant organ made of a cave. And so Robert's dad had to invent all these parts and processes along the way, especially when it came to the waterproofing.
My dad thought, well, maybe we could just coat it with something. So he got a lot of beeswax and a hot plate, and then I would dip the magnetic pickups in the beeswax. And I would do this repeatedly until a sufficient coating had been applied.
On weekends, the entire family, Leland Sprinkle, his wife Harriet, and their two small boys, would drive the 2 hours to Shenandoah Valley. And Leland would work long days in the Luray Caverns. And then afterwards, he'd come home in the evening and take off his muddy boots just outside the apartment door.
Since my father realized that what he was doing would sound crazy, he encouraged me and my brother not to discuss it. And we didn't. We didn't tell anybody. And it was kind of strange because when he would come home, he would put his boots, which were covered with mud, on the front porch. And anybody could walk by and wonder, you know, what is this guy, a grave robber?
No, not a grave robber. Just a math and science genius from the Pentagon building a pipe organ in an ancient cave. Robert's right. It sounds pretty wild when you say it out loud. But it also sounds really beautiful.
He approached it as an artist would approach a very big, you know, like the Sistine ceiling or something, or Mount Rushmore. He wanted it to survive him. He wanted people to understand it and be moved by it.
Now, here's another thing to know about Leland Sprinkle, the engineer.
He was a musician. He was trained as a concert organist. He gave recitals on the radio.
Before he had a wife and kids and a job at the Pentagon, Leland Sprinkle spent a semester studying with a world-famous organist at the Peabody Conservatory in Johns Hopkins University. We called the music school and confirmed Leland was there for one semester as a special student. So this pipe organ was a true labor of love for Leland, something kind of only he could have made.
This was a way to merge not just his interests, but his abilities. There was no personal ambition in this, but there was an artistic ambition and an engineering ambition.
Leland worked his 9-to-5 in the Pentagon and spent his weekends in the Luray Caverns, scavenging around to find just the right stalactites. In the end, only two of the stalactites he picked were naturally in tune. The other 37, he meticulously shaved down to get them to play the exact right pitch. An organ was brought in and set up on a platform, and each key was wired to a tiny rubber mallet, which in turn lightly tapped its chosen stalactite, which then rung out a perfectly tuned note. The entire cave was a musical instrument. After 3 years of work, the organ was finally ready for its debut. On June 7th, 1957, a small audience gathered for the inaugural concert inside the cave. Leland Sprinkle came out and took his place. He sat down at his creation and started to play. In the audience was the Washington Post music critic, Paul Hume.
He drove to Luray, and he sat there being dripped upon by stalactites from the ceiling.
Mr. Hume was known for his harsh reviews, someone who was notoriously tough to please. But he sat through the concert without complaint. And when it was over,
he loved it. And not only did he love it, he actually named it. He called it the Great Stalactite Organ. And my dad loved the name, and so that's been the name applied ever since.
Leland Sprinkle continued to work on the organ for years. We talked to folks who worked at the caves with Leland Sprinkle, and they said he always showed up in a full suit and tie. He was kind and serious. He would work until late in the night, until 2 a.m., not knowing that the sun had set outside, tinkering, tweaking, improving the organ for the rest of his life. For Leland, this is where his love of music and his love of engineering came together. The music of the natural world with a little dose of mathematical genius.
No one else would have done it, and he was intent that it be done well. He thought he had given humanity a gift to be able to hear music that was millions of years old and had been waiting patiently to be heard.
Leland Sprinkle passed away in 1990, but the great stalactite organ lives on. And what you're hearing now is a recording of Leland himself playing the stalactite organ in the Luray Caverns. So let's let Leland play us out. If you visit the Luray Caverns, be sure to stop in the Cathedral Room, where you'll find the great stalactite organ. Over the years, millions of tourists have passed through these caverns and heard this music. To preserve this special instrument, visitors are not allowed to touch the organ, but no worries, you can still hear the music. There's a button you can press, and the organ will spring to life and tap out a melody on the very stalactites that Leland Sprinkle tuned by hand.
Those stories came from the Atlas Obscura podcast, a short daily celebration of the world's strange and wondrous places. On their show, you'll hear about a crystal cave in Mexico, a wishing tree in Portland, Oregon, an alien gravesite in Texas, and so much more. The show is super well produced, well written, and consistently awe-inspiring. Subscribe to Atlas Obscura right here in your podcast player. 20,000 Hertz is produced out of the sound design studios of DeFacto Sound. Find out more at defactosound.com.
This episode was reported by Heidi Shin. Our production team includes
Doug Baldinger,
Chris Naka,
Camille Stanley,
Willis Ryder Arnold,
Sarah Wyman,
Manolo Morales,
Tracy Samuelson,
John Delore,
Peter Clowney.
Our technical director is
Casey Holford.
This episode was mixed by Heidi Shin. I'm Dylan Thuris.
I'm Johanna Mayer.
And I'm Dallas Taylor. Thanks for listening.